If you've bought property, you likely funded your purchase partly through a mortgage. If the property increases in value over time by more than the cost of the borrowing, you're better off. In the stock market, using debt is often called gearing. The new BetaShares Wealth Builder Funds, ASX ticker symbols G200 and GHHF, offer moderate gearing across Australian and global shares for investors who are comfortable with the higher risks associated with gearing their investments. You can discover how they work by visiting betashares.com.au. Please don't forget that gearing magnifies gains and losses, so read the relevant PDS and TMD on the website and consider if the fund is right for you. BetaShares Capital Limited is the issuer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is a podcast by the Rask Group. It's for educational purposes only. So please do not make a financial, legal, investment or taxation decision based on solely what you hear in this show.
Welcome to the Australian Property Podcast.
We're on a mission to be Australia's most trusted property podcast.
I'm Owen Rask, founder of the Rask Group.
I'm Pete Wargent, author and buyer's agent.
I'm Amy Linardi, and I am a buyer's agent.
I'm Chris Bates, ex-financial planner and mortgage broker.
Together, we'll take you through every step of your property journey.
From first home buyer to decades of property investing.
G'day, welcome to the Australian Property Podcast, our weekly 2 cents segment. I'm Pete Wargent from Allen Wargent Property Buyers in Brisbane, and I'm here with Chris Bates from Flint Group. Chris, how's things?
Life's good, Pete. Life's good. It's another month of sickness is still kicking on. I'm sure everyone's sick of hearing it on this on every Sunday, but all the family's got RSV now, so it's young kids, a little nuclear weapons. Other than that, we are moving into a new office this week, which is exciting. And it's a really interesting policies have come out with the banks. With one of the big four, we've got a 95% no LMI deal that we're doing a pilot on, which is a bit of a crazy deal product, particularly for people who are earning more than $400,000 or $500,000. Which is only obviously a subset of the market, but we're doing a lot of work in that space. But what's been keeping you busy?
You can probably answer a question on this. So I shared a bit of that on social media, as I'm wont to do. And of course, light up the switchboards, it didn't go down too well. But my reading of that would be, I mean, who's going to qualify for a $2 million loan, no LMI, 5% down? I mean, yes, trust fund kids and their parents, but it's obviously for the top end of the market, restricted to a couple of hundred blue chip postcodes largely. But is that something that would exist normally, or is this just a whole new space?
No, it's I guess the banks are looking at it and going like on higher incomes, buying into lower risk suburbs at a higher price points, maybe we want to bank those customers longer term. If we get them on a low LVR deal, they won't be able to refinance that loan for some time, and it's good money for us to make and the good customer long term. And so what they're saying is that, we think that's a really low risk bet. If we do enough due diligence on them, making sure all their credit needs to be squeaky clean, they need to have good saving history. They do put an extra few layers in terms of their checks, but they're also saying they're the type of customers they want to bank long term. And so it's really only for a subset of the market, but it does change the game for some people who do want to stretch, who haven't got enough cash, because typically once you're borrowing more than, $4 or $5 million or purchase prices, you're not going to go into LMI territory. And if you could, it would be just enormous. And so it just allows people to upgrade sooner or upgrade and still keep some money left over as buffers. Because typically you needed a 30% deposit once you started going over a few million dollars, and that dropped to 20%. But with this policy, it's potentially only 5%. So not many people listening to this would probably qualify for that, in fairness, because it's only a small number of the population generally. However, it's just interesting when you're seeing bank innovation, and I think we're going to start to see more and more policies like this start to come out where banks are able to target certain segments of the market and potentially start offering longer loan terms, et cetera, to increase borrowing capacity. And that's just the name of the game the banks try to play.
This is what I think sometimes about unintended consequences. If you think about how bank executives are going to be remunerated and the targets for revenue and profit, they're going to find ways to lend. So if you shut off lending down here for first home buyers and people at the lower income spectrums, then banks are going to come and lend over here. They're going to find a way. It's a bit like decades ago when they blocked off the Niagara Falls. You know, they thought, right, we're going to try and repair, because there was detritus building up at the bottom of the waterfall. So they blocked it off. And then, of course, you know, you have unintended consequences downstream at the other waterfalls, which get completely wrecked by the flow of water. It's going to go somewhere. That's the way I look at it. And yes, you can shut off lending to people with this 3 percentage points buffer, but banks are going to find ways to lend. And if it goes into the top end of the market, well, that's not necessarily a good thing for the market or for society as a whole. So yeah, anyway, it's what it is.
That's the point, Pete. That is the point. You know, at the moment, you know, it's much harder for medium and lower incomes to borrow. All the lending data is showing that. And the story is absolutely getting out in the media more and more that lending's not equal weighting to what it was in the past. It's heavily weighted to the higher and medium incomes. But, you know, the banks can't lend to the lower incomes right now just because servicing's so tight. Some of the higher income people can't stretch because they haven't got the deposit. So what they're saying is, well, maybe we can get around the deposit hurdle. And it's a good little risk bet for the banks because borrowing capacity is so tight right now that even if they are leveraging up, they're only leveraging up at 4.5 times their income, not 7 times their income. And so, and they're also leveraging up with 3% above 6% rates, right? So they are protected, the banks, you know, assuming that person keeps their job or assuming their business continues to do quite well. So that's the risk the banks are taking, or assuming the property prices go back up. So I think you're right, though. The banks will always find a way to increase their overall credit growth.
Yeah, it's like whack-a-mole, isn't it? You whack it down here, but it pops up there. Or if you think about a river or waterfall, you can block off certain parts of it, but the water's going to go somewhere. And yeah, we're moving the flows now from lower income borrowers to just people who can easily afford the Toorak's or the Bellevue Hills of the world. But is that a good thing? Well, no, not really in my opinion, but apparently it's all in the name of risk. So interesting, you're like a bellwether for the office market, Chris. I read in JLL's report this morning that Sydney is now actually recording the strongest net absorption rate for office space, but it's all prime grade and the second grade assets are still languishing. Vacancy rates are still pretty high, 15% nationally, but people are generally moving from poor quality office space into prime grade. And I think as well, a lot of businesses are pushing that return to the office rate higher now in 2024. So Sydney absorption, Melbourne as well. Also CBD pedestrian activity in Melbourne is pretty much back to where it was pre-pandemic, and Brisbane's been recording net absorption for, well, 8 quarters in a row now, obviously booming in Brisbane. But yeah, I think if you look at office completions for the next 2 years, they're expected to be about 50% of normal levels. So I think that is probably a good news story for the office sector space on the landlord side. I think it suggests that eventually things will rebalance, but it might take until 2027. So there's some pain in the post there. But if you're negotiating a lease, happy times, and you can move up to a nice harbourfront view maybe, or somewhere a bit closer to the CBD.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely it does put a bit of a challenge on anyone who has got a commercial property that's a B or a C grade, right? And we've got a big residential shortfall, and repurposing these towers isn't as simple as it seems, right? Moving an office tower to residential. But so what do? Do you refurb it? Well, even if you refurb it, you've got to spend a lot of money. As it is, it's still going to lease out. You just have no tenant. You know, who owns it? You know, is it a super fund? Does it get revalued? Is it in a property trust? So I think it's going to be playing out for a number of years. And there's so much new stuff still getting built that was just approved in the boom, and it's still going to hit the market. And so, yeah, absolutely, signing leases right now, you can negotiate big discounts. But Yeah, I do think it's the best stuff because people are trying to get people back to the office and people are saying, well, if it's not better than my home office, why would I want to come in? And I think that's the challenge for employers to
Yeah, you're not going to go back and work in a chicken coop if you've been working from home for 3 years, are you? So it'd be like Google was ahead of the curve on this. Try and make the office space or the workspace somewhere where people actually want to hang out, and that will help. So, yeah, I'm heading down to the Gold Coast this week, talking about booming areas. That's probably the one part of the country where construction is really still teeing off. Maybe Perth as well to some degree. It'll be interesting to see, though, because I haven't been down there for a little while. And I'm speaking at a wealth retreat event. I've been speaking there for the best part of a decade now. It'd be interesting to catch up with some people. I've learned from one of the speakers there, Tom Corley, who wrote a book, Rich Habits. So he did this big study of US millionaires to try and work out what are the common threads. And yeah, I learned a lot from him over the years. So it'd be interesting to catch up and see what's happening down in the Gold Coast as well. So let's rip into these top three stories this week then, Chris. 10 minutes in, we should probably get to it. So RLB released their crane index. Crane count is off record highs, but it's still pretty high. If you look around the country, you can still see a lot of cranes. So we'll do a deep dive there into where is still seeing high levels of construction and where things are dropping off. Secondly, Arcadis, this was another report on international construction costs. Race for capacity, you can see the pressures in the sector as people are still building a lot of infrastructure and non-residential. Australia's a big part of that story as well. And then thirdly, RBA had a bit of a piece out or a publication in the bulletin saying that although the cash rate is on hold, across the market on outstanding mortgage rates, still things are trending higher as more fixed rates reset. So we might just talk a bit about, as we already have actually, who's borrowing, what type of questions and loans they're asking about. And Chris is obviously right at the coalface there. So Chris, let's start with the RLB report. Crane count, 869 in the first quarter of 2024. So it's not as high as previously, but it's the second highest ever reading. Gold Coast is absolutely booming, as I'll no doubt see over the next week. Half of the cranes are in New South Wales, but a lot of this stuff is commercial, though. I think if you look at some of the biggest sites, Amazon building a massive commercial data center in Craigieburn, in Melbourne, in Victoria. I think actually, if you look around the traps, there's quite a lot of stalled projects as well in the residential space. Insolvencies, I suppose, depending on how you look at it, are at 25-year highs. I think you could certainly argue that as a percentage of companies registered, then it's not quite so dramatic, but certainly things are trending up. And I suppose if you looked at that, you would say, well, the construction sector is pretty healthy in terms of the pipeline, but actually starting to trend down now, especially for residential and especially in Sydney.
Yeah, I think that's if you look at the cranes around our city, you think, oh, wow, it's still booming. There's still lots coming. But I think a lot of these cranes are slowly going to go and they're not going to get replaced, or at least for residential. So I was looking at the report, at least 60% are still in the resi space. But like you say, there's lots in, infrastructure. I was in Melbourne a couple of weeks ago and there was like 10 cranes or maybe not that many, but on the northeast link there, it was crazy. Yeah, that Greensboro sort of pocket there and seeing that. So yeah, I do think it's when you're looking around, you're seeing all the cranes are in Gold Coast, you think, oh wow, it's boom time. But when you look at the figures like CoreLogic and actual approvals coming through and actual sales, you would say that, you know, these cranes aren't going to get replaced. And I think that's it's a really good report to watch, because I think you can see that and compare it to longer term standards. I mean, it is crazy how many we are at almost all-time highs versus that just shows that, how much development we've done in the last couple of years and how not just in the resi space, but non-resi.
It is. There's an interesting debate, actually. I was looking at the population clock earlier today for something completely unrelated. 27.2 million estimated residential population. If my memory serves, we only went through 27 million January. So we're still running, at least on the estimates, population growth of 1,900 a day, near enough. So that's what, 680,000 plus a year. And, you know, some people would say, well, you know, as a percentage of the population, that's 2.5%. So is that a problem? Well, I suppose it depends whether you're looking at percentages or absolute numbers. And obviously, as the population gets bigger, then 2.5% gets, well, the number is huge, 680,000+. In some parts of the country, like WA, the population growth rate is near 3.5%, which is just, it's borderline out of control. Then you can't build for that. So, yeah, I think there's still some big numbers, but then we're trying to build for a record or unprecedented population growth. I saw the figures for Canada over the year to March. Again, another record high, or at least the highest in 66 years or something, up 1.27 million. It's a lot of people, and it's not just Australia that's grappling with this. And yeah, I mean, we actually do need the number of cranes to stay near record highs to account for that level of population growth.
Yeah, I was actually looking at the CoreLogic monthly report, a couple of weeks ago, and it was sort of showing the capacity of what we build in the detached housing and also, you know, in multi-res, you know, everything from townhouses to apartments. And you sort of look at those lines over 10, 15, 20 years. And, you know, what we were building 10, 15, 20 years ago is sort of similar to what we were building today. And I just sort of wonder, have we always just got a capacity restraint? Maybe a lot of that's getting taken up in infrastructure and other segments now. So even though our population has, you know, risen, we're taking a lot of our labor into other markets rather than resi. But it just shows that, you know, that how ambitious it was for the government to say, let's go and build 1.2 million homes over 5 years, when, you know, that's just not what we've done in the past. It just feel like there's always just this natural capacity restraint, and let alone all the building issues and material issues we've had over the last couple of years. And so that was an interesting thing. I mean, this probably leads into story number two around construction costs, Pete.
It definitely does. Yeah, budget night is coming up, actually. Only just a few weeks away now. So it'll be interesting to see what announcements are made this time around, because most budgets need a tagline or a big headline. Last time it was 1.2 million homes in well-located parts of the country. I don't know what we're going to get this time, but there's always an expectations management thing there to be resolved by Jim Chalmers. So that'll be an interesting one to watch. So you're right, though. The second story, race for capacity, was the subject of Arcadis, their international construction cost report. So I think if you look at what the report says, reading through it, construction capacity is very tight. As you said, there's a few things driving it. There's a big net zero push in New South Wales that's going to come. We've got the Olympics coming up in Brisbane, which preparations have barely begun, really, in that side of things, and there's a long way to go. Mentioned already data centres and non-residential tech developments. That's taking some of the capacity away from residential. I think if you look internationally, construction costs, it was interesting to see London top of the tree there. In Australia, pretty high, certainly if you compare it to a country like Malaysia or somewhere like that, because our labour costs are high. We don't have cheap labour in this country. Queensland is, we mentioned, I think, on a previous episode, a big push for construction wages increases. Well, yeah, some big numbers being thrown around. Whether or not they're awarded is another question. But that is really one of the things that keeps construction costs in Australia relatively high compared to some of our peers. I think cost pressures do seem to be easing back a bit. Looks like we might get around 3% inflation in construction costs in Australia this year. But I think clearly there's no going back to that level of ultra low funding costs and interest rates that we did see. And that's really what fueled the boom, along with the home builder stimulus. So probably the new normal might be interest rates in the, probably 2 to 4% range, not zero.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at this report and I was a little bit optimistic, to be honest. I thought, well, hang on a sec. Yes, we're higher compared to our region, but when you compare us to around the world, like, it's the same challenge that a lot of other countries are having in terms of actually building it. It's actually just really expensive all around the world. And if anything, we're actually a little bit cheaper. And so I thought it was really interesting just to do a global comparison when you are looking at, the construction costs, because, we can think how dire it is here, but if it's a global issue, then it's a little bit easier to sort of swallow.
If you look at the location index, London ranks at 114. So it's benchmarked to Amsterdam. No idea why. Maybe something to do with the Herengracht index or something, but if you look at Amsterdam as being a benchmark of 100, London is 114. Most expensive cities are like Boston, Zurich, Copenhagen, Munich, San Fran, and Manchester. Sydney's a bit further down the list, 97. So I guess, look, it's a bit cheaper than some of these other areas, but not massively so. I think there's some cities that are a bit cheaper again, like Dubai, but that they have, I suppose, imported labour in some of those cities, which we don't have to the same degree. So, yeah, it's interesting to look around the traps. Clearly, at the moment, the challenge is we're trying to build for a level of demand that we haven't previously had to tackle. And as you said, at the same time, we've got construction margins in the residential space. They're pretty thin anyway. We've got wages going up. We've still got shortages, trades, materials. I think I've lost count of how many insolvencies I've seen reported in the media this week, but it's a lot. And there's a lot of stuff that happens downstream from that. Trades and creditors not being paid, people being laid off. I think the number of job applications per job advertisement is pointing towards a rise in unemployment. Because, yeah, the construction sector, especially in residential, is a big, well, it has a very strong multiplier effect across the economy. So, yeah, I think there's definitely challenges and we're seeing more insolvencies. But hopefully it looks like we might be through the worst of that cost inflation anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I read another article on the Urban Developer, which made a good point around really the opportunity in somewhere like Brisbane, where you are, to start to get really into this multi-res, the townhouse developments. You know, there was a huge boom in that, you know, circa 5 years ago, and there was just a lot of supply and maybe building prices are cheaper. And but once house prices have gone back up, there's been this real lag in, you know, new townhouses getting built. And, you know, a lot of developers aren't playing in that space because it's not big enough. But ultimately, if you can, you know, with the attack on sort of NIMBYism, right, and more relaxed sort of planning controls in Brisbane are a bit more relaxed than, say, New South Wales. But, you know, do you think that's, Pete, you're going to start to see a bit of a mini boom of, you know, townhouses? Because, you know, another article which we read in Domain is sort of saying, well, the best streets, to get into the best parts of the best suburbs is quite expensive, but to get into the more cheaper parts or the poorer parts or the, you know, the cheaper parts of a suburb, that gap can be quite big, which is a great opportunity for people who, you know, can only enter at a certain price point but want to enter in a suburb. Maybe they can't afford a house and then knock it down and renovate it, but maybe they can afford a nice townhouse. And so I don't think there's a lack of demand there, but it's surprising we aren't seeing more and more of that in the Brisbane market.
It goes right to the heart of the NIMBYism debate, because in Brisbane there was a ban on townhouse development in some of the inner suburbs. So that was at a time when we were massively oversupplied. But now we're at the other end of the cycle. We've got a real shortage of housing. We've got massive net interstate migration to southeast Queensland. I don't think citywide there's much of a restriction on where and where you can develop. If you look at a place like Hamilton, North Shore, I mean, that area on its own could probably take 25,000 people when the time is right in the cycle, when the demand's there for off-the-plan apartment sales. But there's a few things holding the market back at the moment. Borrowing capacity is one. The surcharge on foreign buyers who tend to buy a lot of new apartments, that's another. There is that planning restriction in some areas on townhouses. So there's a few levers there, but obviously interest rates is probably the big one. And at the moment, it's pretty tough to see a lot of the projects stacking up. The margins are too thin. So probably need to see prices rise before you start to see that supply response. But I do believe, though, when the time comes, I think we'll see across Brisbane, there is a lot of places that can be developed around train stations, a lot of inner suburbs where you can go pretty high on the tower blocks, Fortitude Valley, South Brisbane, even around Toowong Station. There's a lot of places that could be developed further, but at the moment, the appetite's pretty low. But I'm sure 2 or 3 years' time, we'll be talking about a different stage of the cycle and a different story.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a good opportunity, to be honest. I think both in New South Wales and up there in Queensland, for those developers that can build a high-end product that competes with the housing market, also targets the downsizer market. And I think you can see that in places like Double Bay and Sydney, how, you know, the developers who have got a bit of cash, who can get some good sites, are actually still finding that the feasibility stacks up. And that's actually ultimately good for the whole market, right? If we can start to move people out of houses, particularly the downsizers, or reduce housing demand because they've, you know, more options for families, it does slow down the pressure on a small number of either apartments that suit downsizers that families also want. So we do really need to encourage this next wave of developments, assuming building standards are there, assuming they start to become family friendly, and actually are what we need. So I do think there's, otherwise, ultimately, we're still going to see this lack of listings, lack of supply and growing demand and demographics and population growth. And so I do think we need to get on the development front foot, but I do think we need to do it in a smart way that, you know, gives respect to the location, the nature, the community, and actually builds a quality product that's going to last and isn't just going to be looking old after a couple of years like what we've built in the past. And so it's going to be interesting to see how we pivot over the next few years.
Defects are always they're an issue with new apartments, or certainly they were in the previous cycle, hopefully better this time around. So third and final story this week, Chris, mortgage rates are still rising across the markets for outstanding loans. So the RBA put this in its bulletin. I think we touched on this maybe a week or two ago. There's been a brutal increase in debt servicing for Australia compared to elsewhere in the world. So some fixed rate mortgages are still resetting. So outstanding mortgage rates. If you look at Australia since the first rate hike, we've seen close to 3.5 percentage points across the entire market of increase in outstanding mortgage rates. That compares to the US, which is about 50 basis points. Canada, New Zealand and the UK are somewhere between the two. If you look at the change in debt service ratios, Australia is up nearly 6%. UK is flat. So incomes are up in the UK and people are by and large servicing their debt. And this is really about Australia's proliferation of variable rate mortgages. So there was a short period there where in 2022, and you would know this as the broker, about 40% of loans were fixed rate mortgages as they were being written. But a lot of those have rolled off now. Normally in Australia, only about 20% of mortgages, certainly pre-pandemic, were fixed rates. And this is the knock-on impact of this is that Australia's had a massive decrease in its household disposable income. If you look around the rest of the world, well, wages are up, earnings are up, yes, inflation's up, and people haven't been too badly impacted. In Australia versus the G7, we've seen a massive decrease, and it's taking its time to flow through to things like the retail figures, but you can see what's coming. And as the RBA pointed out, even if the cash rate doesn't change, we've still got the average mortgage rate still creeping up. So what are you seeing in terms of the coalface, Chris? What kind of questions are borrowers asking? Are they more concerned about things like rental yields? Are they worried about what's coming for interest rates? What sort of loans are you writing and what sort of questions are you fielding?
Look, I do think there's the demand for the opportunistic upgrader who hasn't really been in the market. You know, like a lot of the first home buyers, they're either in or out, you know, whether they've got the deposit and enough cash to enter at the price point they want. Some of them are actually going, well, I'll just buy an investment property. I just can't see when my income's going to go up, my cash is going to go up enough to enter into a property that I want to live in long term. So they're going down that rent fencing strategy, which is a bit dangerous because you've just got to be really careful on what you're going to do around your housing. You've got to think through your long-term lifestyle. But I do think there is that opportunistic upgrader there, but usually they're in the market. I can think about one client today who's just sold, who's going to enter a house in the Central Coast. They sort of want to get ahead of rate cuts or ahead of when borrowing capacities fall. So, you know, because they are headwinds at the moment, right? That they can turn to tailwinds if the confidence shifts. However, I would absolutely say that they're not gung-ho and they're not just rushing to buy any property. And that's why I think you're seeing very patchy results and auction clearance rates start to reduce a little bit. Because I think they're saying, well, look, I do want to get ahead of it, but I'm not so sure when it's going to happen. And I'm not that concerned that any property is going to run on me. So I'm going to be really patient. And ultimately, though, I think what we're going to see, it's into May already, next week. I don't think we're going to see many listings. I think, you know, a lot of people are going to see a real drop off in listings into winter. And I think you're going to see a real lag in listings in spring because people aren't going to rush to sell until they can find something. So I think this Mexican standoff is going to continue unless there's a real confidence around our inflation coming back and rate cuts are imminent. They've been pushed back out to 2025, right? And I think that's just going to hold off sellers in the marketplace. It's going to really reduce listings. So I would just say there's this nervous optimism there. I think we're not seeing major issues with debt stress. We're absolutely seeing people coming back to us with their fixed rates and making sure they're on the best rates and doing what they can to get through to the other side. But I do think, a lot of first home buyers are getting pushed out just because, really what they want to buy at and where they want to buy and what they can borrow, it's just a mismatch. So unless they've got access to big deposits into generational wealth, they're just not in the market. And I think that's a real issue right now where, because borrowing capacity is so tight. But if you relax borrowing capacity, that will very, very quickly get factored into prices. Like it has in that long-term correlation is really strong. But at the moment, that's not correlating. Borrowing capacity is down, but prices have gone back up because there's all this intergenerational wealth coming down because people, the parents and the grandparents are seeing it's a good time to buy for their kids. And so it's, the haves and have-nots are really extrapolating out in downturns. And that happens in stock markets where, the people who haven't got much money sell at the worst time. The people who have got money put more money in and they make money on downturns. And I think that's what's happening a little bit in the property market here is that, the mismatch between where the wealth's going is unfortunately not even.
You're right. We're recording this week a little bit early because there's Anzac Day on the Thursday and you'll be busy playing two up. We're recording this before the release of the latest inflation figures. Now, I guess so at the moment I'm flying blind, but it looks to me if you look at market forecasting, they're generally pointing towards that disinflationary trend continuing for Australia. But if you look at market pricing for interest rates, probably no change until 2025. The RBA bulletin looks at what's going to happen to mortgage repayments. So they're going to keep creeping higher essentially for the next four quarters or 12 months because of that cumulative roll-off in fixed rate mortgages as they roll off and become variable rate mortgages. So if you look at the projection for housing mortgage payments as a share of disposable income, it's about 10% now, but it's going to creep higher to maybe 10.5%. And that'll be higher actually than we saw even at the previous peak in 2008 as a share of the overall market. So yeah, it's very much a restrictionary setting for the economy in general. But I think you're right. Most people, it seems, they've acknowledged what's happened and they're taking corrective action, either phoning to get a cheaper mortgage rate, probably working a bit harder. I know a lot of people who are self-employed are just having to put their foot on the accelerator a bit just to keep up with the mortgage repayments. And as well, I think if you look at what the RBA pointed out, if you look back over the past 15 years, we've generally been making a lot of extra repayments on mortgages, either into offset accounts or early repayments. And I think that will cushion some of the blow. People will stop making extra repayments at the same rate. So, I mean, those are obviously optional. It stopped during the pandemic for a short while as people were working out what the hell was going on. But then generally over the past 15 years, maybe an extra 2% plus of household disposable income has been going into these extra mortgage repayments and building up buffers. So that does actually help to cushion the blow a little bit. And a lot of households are, of course, have been well ahead on their mortgage repayments. So yeah, I think you would have expected mortgage arrears to kick up more than they have done so far.
Yeah, and I do think there's people selling, particularly investors. I can see that, because if you have got a what you thought would be positive is now negative, you're not getting much growth. And I think that's going to, unfortunately, that's all people bailing at a time when we do need more investors entering than leaving because we've also got a rental crisis. And so I think that's the thing to really watch over the next 12 months, right? Let's say we extrapolate out higher rates for longer. I think what you will see is more and more investors abandoning a lot of homeowners hanging tight and trying to get through this window. So listings will stay really low. You will see a little bit of downsizing, et cetera, because prices have been up. So that's creating a little bit. But that's this freeze of transactions at the middle to higher end. But I think you've always seen a little bit of turnover. Like sales numbers have been quite good over the last 12 months, really considering. But I do think it's heavily skewed towards the middle and lower end of the market, not the top end. And because the middle and top end is frozen because people can't afford to move.
It definitely is. And that'll be one thing to watch, the regulatory buffer, the lending. So let's wrap up on those three stories this week. So crane count remains near record highs, but a lot of that isn't actually in the residential space. Second story, race for capacity, and somewhat related story, really, that there's a real squeeze on the construction sector as we push towards net zero and some of these massive infrastructure projects and tech developments and data centers and so on. Construction costs, well, hopefully we're through the worst of the inflation, but still pretty high. And mortgage rates across the market are still rising, said the RBA, largely with the fixed rate mortgages rolling off. And that's going to continue for another 12 months as people gradually get back to normal on variable rates. So that's kind of the main stories this week. Don't forget to keep an eye out for my new book coming out actually over the next 4 or 5 days. So if you're passing through an airport, The Buy Right Approach to Property Investing by Kate Bacos and Pete Wargent, in all good bookstores, as they say. So grab yourself a copy. And Chris, what are your plans for the weekend?
We're actually not playing two up, but we're going camping with a group of five families. So yeah, we're get better in hopefully 2 days and then probably destroy ourselves, you know, running around kids for 4 days on a campsite. But yeah, up the coast, actually, somewhere in the Southwest Rocks. I'm not exactly sure the spot, but it's meant to be beautiful. I've seen some photos, and so I'll report on that next week. And yeah, hopefully we get some good weather. Camping in good weather, it's, you know, camping in bad weather, it's a different game, isn't it? So
I've done it in the Blue Mountains, and it wasn't fun. So yeah, I'll be at the Gold Coast for the next week if you're around. So you might see me around in a Hawaiian shirt or something, but definitely keen to see what's happening down there because all of the data is pointing to a boom down there. Construction, apartment pre-sales, everything, it's all happening. So yeah, it'll be good to see it close up. And then the week after that, I'm over in WA, first time in years, actually. So yeah, traveling around a bit. So send us any questions. Always keen to cover whatever's hot and whatever's topical. So yeah, do leave your feedback, send in the questions, links in the show notes. And Chris, look forward to catching up next week.
Thanks, Pete. Talk next week. Happy Sunday.
Thanks for tuning into the Australian Property Podcast.
If you love the show, why not subscribe or leave us a review on Apple or Spotify?
And if you want to work with me, Amy, Pete or Chris,
you'll find links in your podcast player to get in contact with us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Australian Property Podcast. We're huge advocates of getting the right advice at the right time from the right people. That's why it's important to understand that this podcast episode contained general financial information only. It is not designed to be specific or personalized to your financial, tax, or legal situation. With property, the check sizes are pretty big, so it's important you get advice from a licensed and trusted professional before acting on the information you hear in RAS podcasts. Thanks again.
For more than a decade, I've been hunting for the best investors and their methods, strategies, and tools for investing. After years in the industry, countless books, a few degrees, and 1,000 podcasts and live shows, I've rolled this accumulated knowledge into something called Rask Invest. If you've ever heard me talk about a core and a satellite, active and passive, true long-term compounding, or you simply want to know exactly how I would invest, now is your chance. Rask Invest is our new investment service, designed for all types of investors who want professional management of their core portfolio at a low cost from a team they trust. Rask Invest helps you automate your wealth creation and passive income. Simply click the link that says Invest with Owen in your podcast player to join one of our live platform walkthroughs or book a call with us. You can also view the Rask Invest PDS and TMD and get invested with me.